Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. Another year is upon us. I'm Ryan Balogie. It's great to have you here with us. Get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Balogie. You can find Golf News Net at golfnewsnet.com. You can follow us on social media at your favorite social media service. And the handle Golf News Net, we are available on Roku and Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV coming very, 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 very soon. And you can find a little bit of a preview coming very, very soon also of our new golf travel site. Can't tell you a whole lot about it, but a lot has come a long way since the last time we spoke. We're getting ready to launch very soon. The content is literally sitting out there. There are a couple tweaks left to make to the site. We've got everybody on board. We've got the content. I've got to put a little bit of the advertising stuff together. There's going to be less ads at Golf Trip X. Whoops, did I say that? Then our other site, golfnewsnet.com, but it's going to be an awesome reading experience. I'm so happy to have the team together that we do. The same guys that have worked with me for the last couple of years on golf travel. Darren Bunch is going to lead the way for us. Mitch Lawrence is going to be the head man on podcasts and will continue to be a co-host of Talking Golf Getaways, which is the golf travel podcast that you should be listening to. There aren't really many other ones, but you should definitely be listening to him. And then you should also be following Eric Hart, who is the mobile golfer who has been doing golf travel for us for quite some time now. And he's going to be a great contributor, regular contributor to the site. And he's going to be one of our leads in the writing department. And then Brian Orr, who is one of the best darn golf course photographers on the planet, will also be lending some of his expertise with behind the camera work and a little bit of drone work as well. So there's a lot more to come on that front. It will come out very, very soon. I'm so excited about it. It's kind of cool to have a spinoff of GNN as we try to continue to grow a little bit and serve you, the golfer, a little bit better. And I think we're going to be able to do that this year. And then maybe there will be another spinoff to come. But that's later this year, if not in 2020. So let's focus on the here and now. Very excited to be back with you to start a new year on the 19th Hole Golf Show. We've got plenty to talk about from the Tournament of Champions. We've got the Sony Open in Hawaii this week. And then we can kind of start digging in on some other issues as the calendar starts to unfold a little bit. But I would like to start with the Century Tournament of Champions. We haven't talked about PGA Tour golf in a little while. The last event of note was the RSM Classic, the official note, at the end of November. And then we had the Hero World Challenge at the beginning of December, which is a fun event to watch for the 18 players who compete in it. They're all top 50 players in the world. They're all very accomplished players. But it's not official, doesn't mean a whole lot, and ultimately it does mean world ranking points, which I think is absurd, but it's not an official event, and it doesn't really carry any momentum with it, because for most of these guys, it's their final event of the year, then they take weeks off, and then they're either going to compete in an event like the Tournament of Champions, or if for whatever reason they're top 50 and didn't win a tournament on the PGA Tour in the last 12 months, then they probably start the year at Sony, or in the case of someone like Justin Rose, he chose not to play the Century Tournament of Champions. He chose not to play the Sony Open in Hawaii because usually if you do the Tournament of Champions, you're probably going to do the Sony Open in Hawaii. It just makes sense. It's Hawaii. I mean, why would you not take 2 weeks there? So with Rose choosing not to do the Century Tournament of Champions, therefore he chose not to do the Sony Open in Hawaii, where he's had some very good finishes in the past, and instead chose to go to the start of the year at the Desert Classic, which used to be the Bob Hope, which was all kinds of different things. I forget it was most recently the Career Builder Challenge. When that fell through, they were looking for a new sponsor. They did not find one, so this year the PGA Tour is underwriting that expense of the tournament. I assume they will find someone to be a presenting sponsor for this year, although that would have to come, obviously, in the next few days to make that announcement. And then if they find someone who's a good presenting sponsor, maybe they can make them the title sponsor for next year. That's how these things usually work. When the PGA Tour either creates a tournament, like they do on the Web.com Tour so often, or when they're taking a tournament that doesn't have title sponsorship and they need it to go somewhere, they usually try to get someone to come in at the last minute, either an old standby sponsor or someone who's kind of been on the fence about it, as a presenting sponsor, so that they have less of a bill, less of a responsibility to sponsor the tournament. They still get much of the same exposure, except the tournament is presented by them. Their name's not at the beginning, it's at the end, so to speak, at the title of the event. And that's the difference between title and presenting sponsorship, other than the ad inventory that you get on TV. And they did that probably most notably, if you remember, with Farmers Insurance, when they came in and sponsored what is now the Farmers Insurance Open. It used to be the Buick Open, and when Buick walked away, similar thing happened. It was going to be like the San Diego Open or something like that, or whatever it was. And at the last minute, Farmers Insurance, which is owned by the same people who own Zurich Insurance, they came in as a presenting sponsor, and it worked out great for them. And they've been there ever since, and I feel like it's been 10 years at this point. But they've been a part of it for a long time, and that brand for Zurich works really well in that market, and they've done that. To kind of complete the loop on the web.com tour discussion, I was talking with someone the other day, a friend who caddies on the web.com tour, knows lots of the ins and outs of the PGA Tour, and he kind of pointed out to me, it's something I've noticed before, but really made it explicitly clear, that the web.com tour sometimes just kind of creates events out of thin air, and you're like, what the hell's going on here? And one of those events, there were really three last year that were announced, you're like, what is this? One was in Savannah, Georgia, one was in Oxford, Mississippi, and one was in Sarasota, Florida. Now, Savannah and Oxford were played last year. Savannah continues this year on the web.com tour. The Oxford event was an absolute debacle. Rain was a problem. Weather was an issue. Sponsorship was an issue. It's off the schedule. But the Sarasota event, which is going to be played for the first time this year, the web.com tour was able to snag Leecom, who has been a sponsor of the championship at Play and Peak, or Peak and Play, wherever the heck, in New York for... That tournament's been there forever. It's one of the first, one of the originals of the Hogan Tour, now the web.com tour. They got that company to sponsor this Sarasota event for 5 years. They probably gave them a sweetheart deal, and they're doing it at the minimum price for a web.com tour sponsorship, which is the minimum purse is $550,000. And so it's really interesting to think about how those sponsorships do work out. But again, completing the loop on that, hopefully for the Desert Classic, getting someone like Justin Rose, having a defending champion like John Rahm, getting a pretty solid field of commitments. You're going to have Phil Mickelson there. He's basically the de facto tournament host. So having these bigger names there should be really good for the tournament and hopefully will help it land a title sponsor. That leaves us to this week, being the Sony week. This is, to me, one of the most interesting weeks of the year. And I say that because of the way the field is made up. It's a 144-player field. For the most part, it's just based on priority order. So it's just based on whether you're ranked in the higher category than somebody else or not. There's not really much opportunity for web.com tour guys who are graduates or web.com tour finals graduates to get in the field. You basically have to be in one of those top levels of those 50 guys to get a chance to even get into this field. And interestingly enough, Denny McCarthy, who won the web.com tour finals money list, chose not to play in the event this week. So there you go. But and he's fully exempt. So you get a mix. You get guys who are veterans who have been around forever, and they can really take advantage of their status and their ability to go get a week in Hawaii and go play this classic golf course. You kind of have to learn a little bit. And there are so many of those guys that do well every year. Jerry Kelly hardly plays at all on the PGA Tour anymore, but he keeps playing in this tournament year after year, and there's a good reason. He finishes in the top 15 like every year. He loves this golf course. So why would you not play it, even though he's playing Champions Tour golf a lot of the time? You got Zach Johnson, who's coming off the worst year of his professional career, at least as a PGA Tour player. Yeah, I guess you could say probably since 2006 worst year, but one of the worst years of his career. And he's going to go back and start his calendar year at a place where he has done so much damage over the years. You've got Jimmy Walker, who had bouts after coming back from Lyme disease. He had runs where he was playing great golf for a few weeks in a row, then would lose it again, then would kind of get it back. He's trying to get back to the guy who won the 2016 PGA Championship. This is a golf course he loves. I think about Russell Knox, who had a down 2018 compared to his standards, although he had some big highs. And really thought he had a chance there for a while to make the Ryder Cup team. Another golf course that he absolutely loves. You go down the line. Charles Howell III absolutely loves this golf course. He has, I don't think, finished outside the top 15 in the last 5 years. So, again, it's just, there are a number of those guys. But on the other end of it, six of the last seven winners of this tournament played the week prior at Kapalua, which could not be a more different golf course. than what these guys are going to see in Honolulu at Wailea. Rainer versus Core and Crenshaw, or Core Crenshaw versus Rainer, however you want to order it. But big greens versus small greens, smaller fairways versus bigger fairways, city environment versus freaking middle of nowhere, both coastal to an extent, to a good extent. One more exposed to the wind probably than the other. The Kapalua being the one more exposed to the wind than the other. Certainly more rolling terrain on Maui than you're going to see it at Wailea. That's how it is. I mean, there's a reason they settled Honolulu as the capital city of Hawaii on that spot. It's reasonably okay to get around them. But anyhow, it's really interesting to see how the field makes up and then who actually wins the tournament. But I was kind of surprised Rose didn't play. I am happy to see Justin Thomas, who won this event in the past. I thought he had it last year until Patton Kizzire won in a playoff over James Hahn. He thought he had this event 2 years in a row. And I'm happy to see him leading the field. Bryson DeChambeau is playing this week. I think this golf course fits really well with how he plays. Short game is a bigger deal, so it on this golf course, perhaps more than any other on the PGA Tour, the difference between the profile of a player that finishes in the top 25 at Kapalua and the, or top 15, I should say, at Kapalua and the top 25 at Wailea, it's stark in PGA Tour terms. Most weeks, when you look at the kinds of players, the profile of a player that should do well, that should like a golf course, based on its demands of how you have to finish there on the PGA Tour, the difference in short game between the two courses is just absolutely stark. I mean, 20% basically of a top 25 finisher at Wailea, about 20% of their strokes gained for the week comes from short game. In part, that's because you have smaller greens, you have smaller targets, right? You have so many more greens at Kapalua because they're huge, so your strokes gained putting becomes a bigger facet of the discussion. But then you look at driving, and you look at iron play, and iron play becomes a really, really big deal in some facets, but driving becomes remarkably more important. It's really big contrast between what you see to start the year on Maui and what you see a week later in Honolulu. As for the tournament itself, the Tournament of Champions last week, what about Xander Schauffele, man? I mean, I was very impressed by Schauffele over the last couple of seasons. In the first season, he won Greenbrier almost out of the blue. It was like, okay, you know, that's kind of one of those more minor league tournaments. It tends to have a veteran winner, Greenbrier, so that meant something to me that a guy who was a rookie figured out how to deal with that golf course and win it. And then he won the Tour Championship, even though Justin Thomas won the FedEx Cup, but still, he won a tournament of 30 select players and beat 29 of them to pick up a second win in his rookie season, lock up Rookie of the Year honors, and put himself in a position to be in major championships and just have the trajectory of a superstar. And last year, he had some very high spots. I mean, he finished very well in the U.S. Open once again. He has finished top six in the U.S. Open back-to-back years. I know it's not Brooks Koepka-type numbers. Obviously, he didn't win back-to-back years. But to be in the conversation two consecutive years at the national championship, I think is a big deal. And he seems to play difficult golf courses and tough fields really well. So then, in the fall, he wins the WGC HSBC Champions, which is not quite the tournament you think is a tough golf course, right? I mean, Sheshon International is pretty easy for those players. But he had to stare down Tony Finau, who just came off the best season of his professional career, makes him one of the most consistent players in the world, got him into the top 10 in the world. He stared him down, won that title. Then you give him basically a month and a half off, 2 months off, and he wins this tournament. And he did it with an incredible final round that forced him to be really aggressive because he bogeyed the first hole on a par 73 golf course out the gate. So he's probably thinking, Gary Woodland's got a three-shot lead going into the final round. And you think, okay, well, Woodland, so long as he shoots, you know, in the mid-60s, high-60s, he's going to win, right? PGA Tour Radio, I was listening to it coming back. I was doing some errands and went back and forth from Home Depot like three times. And I think on the third time, they were saying, well, if Woodland shot 68 today, he would probably win. And I was like, yeah, I mean, that's 5 under 68, three-shot lead. I mean, someone's got to come from eight back to catch him or got to beat him by 9, you know what I mean, to win. And, well, then Xander Schauffele came out and overcame that initial bogey, made 2 hole-out eagles, one from more than 100 yards, one from closer to 20 yards. He got himself into a position after birdieing 17 with a really tight pin placement. I mean, I know he went in with a mid-iron or, you know, an 8-iron, something like that, 8-iron, 7-iron, but he went in there with an aggressive shot, converted, and when he had to, he knew he had to make the birdie to give any kind of scare to Gary Woodland to make him think that with 17 and then certainly 18, which was a potential eagle opportunity for both those guys, gotta put some circles on the card. So he birdies 17, gets to 18, hits an incredible slinging draw of a wood, I think it was a wood, maybe it was a hybrid, into that green 118, which is now like a 650-yard par 5. It's incredible. And he got to about 10 feet. He had an eagle putt on the final hole of the tournament to set the course record in the final round. Now, he missed that putt, and he hit it a little too hard right through the break that he intended. But he made the birdie. He shot 62 and right in front of Woodland and forced Woodland to make a birdie to extend the tournament, to make a playoff. And Woodland couldn't do it. He laid up with his second shot. He didn't get home in 2. He had a pretty reasonable third shot, rolled out to a decent position, 7-8 feet, to give him a chance to get into extra holes, and he just missed the putt. And maybe in that situation, Woodland, who has become such a better putter working with Phil Kenyon, has dramatically improved his putting. But in that moment, maybe he just missed the putt. Maybe he twitched a little bit. Maybe he went back to an old habit. Don't know. But it was enough. The pressure from Schauffele in front of him was enough to make him not get to extra holes. And that's remarkable to me, because Schauffele has won all 4 of his tournaments, basically coming 3 or 4 of his tournaments, I believe, coming from behind in the final round. So he has no problem trying to catch somebody. It'll be interesting to see as he evolves as a player. He's only 61 starts into his PGA Tour career. It'll be interesting to see as he evolves, will he become a bit more of a front runner? Is he a guy who likes to chase? Does he like to not be near the lead? When he gets there, what will that be like for him? But right now he has 4 wins, and of course you need to know that he has 4 wins, and so does Ricky Fowler, who's several years older than him, obviously. But he also is farther along at this stage of his career, 61 starts in, than pretty much any young guy you could compare him to right now. It's a big deal. And I don't think up to this point people thought a whole lot about Xander Schauffele, but now he's 6th in the world, dude. He is a guy to be messed with. And again, if you look at his finishes in the majors, particularly in the U.S. Open, they're strong. He likes big, strong, difficult golf courses. I know Erin Hills was considered easy, but it was a par 72. So kind of take that out of your memory bank. Take that out of your frame of reference and think of it as hard. He likes U.S. Open setups. I think he's going to like Bethpage. I think you got to think about him, certainly, in the 2 U.S. Open setups for the year. And then he's going to get better at the other majors. He's just going to continue to evolve as a golfer. So I was very impressed by him. I was also equally impressed by Gary Woodland. I mean, he played great all week. First week of a new contract with Wilson Golf. He had played the entire last year, non-contract guy. Was making a big change and making kind of a big statement in trying to do that. He almost did it. So I was impressed by the effort that he turned in. And then behind those 2 guys in the A flight, you had Justin Thomas surge big time on Sunday, which, I mean, he kind of tends to do that. Not that he backdoors tournaments. Sometimes he does. And this was a bit of a backdoor finish. But still, you would consider Xander Schauffele's win that a backdoor win, because he did a lot of it in the final round. I don't think you can do that. So I think for Thomas to have that good final round too really does potentially forebode well for this week in Honolulu. I know he wants to get the year started off right. I know he wants to get closer to number one. He's got to overcome Justin Rose. He's got to overcome Brooks Koepka. A lot of people think over the long haul, Justin Thomas is the guy that's going to be number one in the world for much of the future, because he's just, frankly, a better golfer, and he's younger. So he's kind of got to start making some progress to that. I'm sure there's some self-imposed pressure to that, and that's why I'm going to really enjoy watching about the Sony Open this week. All right, let's take a break here, and I want to tell you again about my friends at Auto Slasher with us again to start the year. And I want to tell you about Auto Slash again, because we're getting near that time of the year for me personally where I start to go on the road a little bit. The PGA Merchandise Show is in a few weeks, and then it kind of starts from there. And with the new golf travel site coming, I'm very excited that I'm going to be doing some more travel. But that means that there's more responsibility to get travel arrangements, there's more to come in rental cars, and that's why I love AutoSlash. AutoSlash is a free service that makes sure you get the best rate possible when you need to rent a car, and that continues on even after you book. And here's how AutoSlash can save you money. They do it in two ways. When you book, AutoSlash will search all of the car rental providers at where you want to pick up your car to find you the best rate. They do that by applying every possible coupon code publicly or privately available to you. And that can mean because you're a member of Costco or you're part of AAA or another organization, you could be saving money on a car rental and not even know it. But AutoSlash does, and they'll ask you those rate questions. Then after you book, AutoSlash will continue to look for those better rates up until the absolute second that you pick up your rental car. Those rates can drop without warning sometimes, either with the provider that you picked or someone else altogether. And so AutoSlash is there to make sure you're aware of those better rates through the rental company that you either picked or that one out there that could be trying to lure you with a little bit better rate. So you can book and rebook, and you can save the most money that way. In addition to helping you save on those pay-at-the-counter rentals, AutoSlash can also offer you big discounts on those prepaid rentals through what's called slash deals, which are refundable up to 48 hours before picking up. That is huge. If you've ever rented a car through a travel site and you pay for it in advance and you almost immediately regret it because you know the money is gone and you can't change it at all, these slash deals are huge. The average AutoSlash user can expect to save 30% or more on their rental, and that's money you can use to have more fun on your vacation, save a little bit of money for your business travel, in my case. Whatever you're doing, you're saving money, and that's good. Try AutoSlash for yourself. It's free, quick, and easy. Head to autoslash.com. Then you can tell AutoSlash your location and travel dates, as well as those potential membership discounts. Let it work its magic finding those discounts for you. And before you know it, you will have an email in your inbox with mind-blowing rates for your rental. Once again, go to autoslash.com and try it for yourself. Okay, so we get into the year with new rule changes, and we saw some of those on display at the Century Tournament of Champions, of course, and probably the one that strikes most people is the one that's the most visually stark, right? The one that changes everything in terms of what you think about when you play golf, and that's putting with the flag stick in. There's been much made of this over the first week of the 2019 PGA Tour season, primarily because Bryson DeChambeau is playing, and he said he would be putting almost exclusively with the flag stick in. And he made the argument that, however convoluted he chose to make it, but he made the argument that a player like him, who sometimes bangs in putts, he will benefit more from having the flag stick in because it will kind of kill the speed of his putts, and the flag stick can catch marginal putts and help them drop to the hole. Well, in the first couple of days of the tournament, he looked like a damn genius. The guy was making everything he looked at, and of course, the natural reaction from someone like Brandel Chamblee at Golf Channel was, oh my god, everyone's going to be doing this by the end of the year. And then in the third round, DeChambeau lost strokes putting. He didn't putt as well. In the fourth round, he was fine. But the first two rounds were great, and then kind of came back to earth a little bit. And so everyone's formed an opinion on this already. They've already decided it's either ugly and gross and horrible and wrong, or it's okay and it's science-based and you should do it. And I think the reality, just like everything else, and perhaps this is I'm too zen to be popular, but I think the zen opinion is, it depends. Sometimes it makes sense to have the flag stick in. When you're hitting a putt outside of 5 feet, you may be able to benefit from having a flag stick in. You certainly could benefit from it on a putt where you're not expecting to hit it dead straight in the hole. I think that's pretty much every putt after 5 feet, especially those ones that swing a lot. For some people, that's going to be a better visual. For some people, it's going to be easier for them because the flag stick, again, will capture more of the holes. That means you're going to have more usable portion of the hole that if you just make contact with the stick, with the ball, it might catch a putt on the edge and help it fall down more than it's going to push a putt away, so to speak. Like, I don't think if I putt with the flag stick in every time, not that I'm doing this, but if I'm putting with the flag stick in every time and I miss on the high side, if I miss on the high side of a right-to-left breaking putt, if I hit that flag stick, it's probably going to go in the hole. And that's a benefit for me because that opens up the right side of the hole. I'm going to come in that way anyway, right, on a right-to-left putt. And on the left side, it may occasionally capture a ball that would have lipped out because maybe it hits the lip and the flagstick and just kind of rattles down in there. But it's not just going to suddenly, like, careen off the left side and push it farther away. Same thing on a left-to-right putt. I think on a downhill putt, you probably have some players who will think about having the flagstick in to try to kill some of that speed and maybe let them hit a little bit more of a natural putt. Let it hit the middle of the stick, die in the hole. I think you don't have to ever worry about that putting uphill. I think the choice is up to you. Again, what's the difference? I mean, if you're going uphill, you're probably going to lose momentum. You're probably die it in the hole unless you just ramrod it. If you're that kind of person, then yeah, you should probably have the stick in. But again, I think it's all kind of circumstantial. It doesn't have to be always yes or always no. Some of it's confidence, some of it's science. I think it's a little bit of everything. But for the recreational golfer, I think probably a lot of you who are listening to this and probably a lot of people who come to GNN, if you're a recreational golfer, you probably, if you've ever played alone, you've probably played with the flagstick in. I know I do. When I play golf by myself, whether I'm testing equipment, whether I'm just out there for fun to get a break during the day, whatever it is, whatever the reason, I usually putt with the flagstick in. And that's because I don't hole everything out all the time. I'm just trying to keep moving. I'm not worrying about every single shot, playing everything by the rules. It doesn't count for handicap anyway, so it's just practice. So why would I not putt with the flagstick in? And there are times when I'll make some putts with the flagstick in there, maybe 6-7 feet, and you go, I wonder if that would have gone in if I'd taken the stick out. Well, now I don't have to worry about it because it's legal either way. So if I want to consider those putts that I make with the stick in legal, I go, okay, great, because they are. But when I compete, when I play in a league or a tournament or whatever, I think it really is just going to boil down to my comfort level. I might try actually having that flagstick in on shorter putts. I'm not the best at short putting. I wonder if it'll inspire some confidence to give me something to hit right toward, almost like another alignment marker toward the hole. It's a theory I've been kind of running around in my head since this rule change was announced, because I know how, if I'm, for example, hitting a 25-foot putt, I'm probably not going to hit it straight at the hole, right? So there's no point, it doesn't matter what's at the hole. That's not what I'm trying to get at. If I hit the putt right, it's going to go in the hole, but I'm not aiming there. But on most short putts, I'm aiming at the hole. I'm aiming dead center or darn close to it. So if I have that extra alignment aid in the flagstick, maybe I make more putts with it. So I'm going to try that out a little bit. But I think the general consensus is having the flagstick in will sometimes hurt you, but more often than not, it will help you. And that leaves it up to you as to whether or not you want to do it, but know that it's there to help you as an advantage, even though the rule change was really designed just to make golf go faster. So take advantage of it. The other thing, the other kind of glaringly noticeable rule change is the change to the drop procedure, right? Forever and ever, you stuck your arm out at shoulder height, you dropped it from your side, or if you learned even before then, you dropped it behind you so you couldn't see it, and that tried to create a degree of randomness, right? But the USGA and the RNA figure, well, so many people kind of drop in their relief area, and the ball rolls away, rolls out because it's either on a side hill or the ground's too hard or they don't do it right or whatever. And they wanted to prevent people from having to drop and redrop and then place. And so they initially said, well, you just keep it 1 inch off the ground. That was the initial idea they proposed. And it's like, okay, well, I mean, I guess. But then they realized if it's 1 inch off the ground, if the grass is 1 inch tall, you just basically place it. And that seemed kind of silly. And so they didn't want to go back and say, well, let's just go back to shoulder height, because then that didn't solve the problem they were trying to eliminate. So they said, okay, well, let's drop from knee height. And they didn't really put out the memo entirely explaining to people how you should drop from knee height. I mean, you kind of get it from shoulder height. You stick your arm out and do it. That's easy. But at knee height, how do you get to knee height? Do you get to near knee height? Do you get to in knee height? What exactly is it? And I think that kind of left professional golfers, particularly the ones that are going to be on TV, kind of demonstrating all these new rules for us until springtime, for many of us, left them wondering, what the heck am I supposed to do? And so, again, Bryson DeChambeau became an example, but others did it too. And taking drops looked like kind of doing a curtsy, moving your knees to the side and to get your arm down there so you can drop. And these guys look like goofs, because they look like they're doing something kind of dainty instead of following the rules of golf. And I think that, and I wrote something about it for GNN, I think that the best way to do this, the moving forward, the way that you're going to least look like an idiot, is just bend over at the waist, bend forward at the waist, put the ball at knee height, almost kind of like you're playing defense in baseball, you know, with your hand, glove on one knee and hand on the other, extend your hand out, and drive it from knee height. As long as it doesn't hit your foot, you did a good job. I think you did it. It doesn't look manly. Some people complain about that online. It doesn't have to look manly or aggressive or whatever. That's stupid. The point is to be practical. So you do it in one drop and you move on with your life. And that's the best thing about it, is some of these rules changes, many of them were designed to make golf easier and less time consuming for normal people. They didn't really care how professional it would look or how they would demonstrate or whatever. They just wanted to make golf a little bit easier and a little less time consuming and a little less to think about. And I think they did that. I think they accomplished that with a lot of the rules. You can now putt, or you can now repair spike marks on the green. That's awesome. You can repair pretty much anything on the green. That's wonderful. You can, if your ball is stuck in the face of a bunker and you got bad knees or you don't want to take a whack at it, instead of declaring it unplayable and you drop it in the bunker, you declare it unplayable and take it out the bunker and play it with a two-stroke penalty. What a good deal for people. They're going to open up opportunities to be able to have more quote-unquote penalty areas. So no longer will you have to have a penalty area that has water in it. It's no longer, that's why it's not a water hazard anymore, because the USGA and the RNA have decided to allow courses and tournament committees to declare more places on the golf course an area where you can take relief by taking a drop. That's great. We were doing that anyway. Now it's official. It's a lot of the stuff, a lot of the things that we do as golfers that just kind of wink and nod about the rules, well, now they're official in some ways. It's great. These are great changes for the most part. I know there are still some complaints about it. I know people think that some of those things have missed the mark. Like, you can't now replace a golf club when you break it in the middle of a round. You can repair that golf club, and you can't replace it. But the good news is, on the converse of that rule, if you smash your putter into your bag and kind of bend it, you can still use it for the rest of the round. So there's some give and take there. But I think overall, the changes to the rules have been super beneficial. I think that you'll see them when you start playing a little bit more come the springtime, or if you live somewhere where you can play all year round, please let me know how the new rules implementation is going. But I think it'll be a benefit, because I think a lot of it is natural things that we do already and just don't talk about and just don't consider them official. The USGA and the RNA kind of mucked it up a little bit because they had to give official language and terminology to all these things that we were doing. So now you have penalty area instead of water hazard, new drop procedure, a back of the line relief, you know, all these kinds of things that people weren't officially talking about before, but you knew as a golfer what they were. Now they have official names, and that's kind of weird, but overall I think it's great. And I think we saw some benefits to that rule, so the rules changes. Webb Simpson benefited by accidentally moving his ball when he was looking for it. Well, he got to be able to put it back pretty close to where it was, and he didn't get a penalty stroke. That was a benefit. So you saw some guys able to take advantage of the new rules, and I think that's good. And I think we'll see some of that, and I'm sure we will see some of the opposite. We'll see some people screw things up, but it really does seem like, for the most part, nothing's really changed that much. You kind of get more benefit of the doubt than anything else in the new rules, not more ways to be penalized. The only really spot where you can get penalized is if you drop from shoulder height or if you tried to replace a golf club, and the PGA Tour wouldn't let you do that anyway. So I think that these are good things. I think they're good changes, and I think people will like them in the end. But let me know what you think. I would love to hear from you. Ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com is my email address. You can tweet me at Ryan Ballingy on Twitter. Not really on Facebook that much, so don't bother there. Next week on the show, we'll talk a little bit about the Sony Open Hawaii. We've got the first European Tour event of the year. We will then soon jump into the LPGA portion of the schedule, because that starts next week too with their Diamond Resorts Tournament of Champions. So that's going to be pretty cool. I'm going to go down there for that Sunday, the final round, and be there in Orlando before the week of the PGA show. So we'll do that as well. We'll do some stuff from down there. Hopefully record a little bit of podcasting from the merchandise show and apparently the new additional show component to it, which is like racket sports or something. So we'll check that out too, because why not? Anyway, if you listen to us through iTunes, please give us a 5-star rating. Helps us reach more people. A nice 5-star review would be very appreciative. It would be the greatest late Christmas present you could give me, greatest early birthday present you could give me, or the greatest birthday present you can give to my wife, whose birthday is January 26th. Whatever you choose, it would be greatly appreciated. And please head over to golfnewsnet.com. Check out GNN Plus. So we are going to have more content this year on GNN Plus. We're already starting to kind of roll out more commentary, more analysis of the news, and more fantasy tools. Great stuff that we're doing over there. You can get a one-month free trial subscription if you just take our survey. It's a like 10-question survey, some vague questions about your age, how often you play golf, and stuff like that. Get a free month. And if you like it, then you can sign up for as little as $8 a year if you sign up for 3 years, or you can get it for $10 a year if you sign up 1 year at a time. So head over to golfnewsnet.com, try that out for yourself. I would greatly appreciate it. Until next time, I'm Ryan Ballengee saying thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.